I'm Natalie. I'm an alcoholic. I have about 2 years of sobriety, or over 2 years of sobriety. I got sober here in the Bay Area. Rehab is part of my story. Suicide attempts are part of my story. Drugs are part of my story. And all of those are included in the big book, so lucky me. Let's see. I'm just going to catch you up to the first moments drinking became the way I got through my days. So when I was 16, I got into a motorcycle accident, and I had an intense brain injury, and I was in the hospital for a couple days. And it completely changed my life. I spoke differently. My brain chemistry was totally different. I was dealing with a lot of post-concussive syndrome, a lot of rage, a lot of confusion, a lot of different personality traits, behaviors. And all I knew that I wanted to do was get out of my own body, because it, first of all, didn't feel like my body anymore. Before that, I had drank and used, and I always drank to get drunk. I don't know why anyone else would drink, but that was the way I did it, always. Because that's the way my family did it, and that's the way I grew up. But when I got into that accident afterwards, I was so utterly confused about who I was and what I was doing and why my body was doing these things that when I got the opportunity to drink and use, I felt that I could leave this like intense confusion behind for just a couple hours. I had a pretty classic life. It was pretty easy up until that point. I was a good student. I played sports. I was super active. And then I sunk into a deep depression, and drugs and alcohol definitely got me deeper in that cycle, and were absolutely a tool I used continuing for like the rest of my life until I got sober. Like, that was my main tool, because at that time, all the tools I had used before, I know I like they didn't work, and I didn't know how to talk to people. I physically for a while couldn't form sentences, but it was the hardest thing I've ever had to go through, and honestly, I'm still dealing with it now. But thankfully, like, the fog has cleared up a little, and my brain has actually started to recover, side note. So yay getting sober, you know? So from there, I did, like, the classic. I went to college. I found the people that drank. I went to a party school, OD'd a couple times, started using in my room by myself. My roommates were like, hey, it's 7 a.m. We have to go to class. And I was like, all right, I'm just going to finish this bottle. I'll be there. And they, you know, quickly, they had lived with me in a dorm before, and then they quickly realized living with me that drugs and alcohol were my life. And I was like, you guys just don't party hard enough. And so classes started getting in the way, so I dropped out to, you know, pursue my career of drinking and using. Also, I was really suicidally depressed at the time, to be more serious about it. And that was the first time where drugs and alcohol really became my life. And I had committed to really killing myself slowly. I mean, I don't know what else to call it, you know? I was like, that's the easier, softer way. I don't want to deal with any of the other shit. So I moved home, got a restaurant job, which I don't know if anyone has ever been in the restaurant industry here, but it's just like a really good place to fuck shit up and just get deeper in my alcoholism. I mean, that was the first time I was exposed to people who were alcoholics and called themselves that. And the first time like people drank to wake up in the morning and to go to work. And I was like, I'm not alone. It was like I had found my people. And so from there, I just went further and further down bad relationships, more using and drinking, bottoms with family, and finally my family told me, like, this is a note before I tell you that, like, I still suffer from chronic pain from my accident, and so drinking and using really was, like, all I knew how to do. Thank God I didn't pick up the narcotics that I kept getting prescribed over and over again. Somehow I just stuck to, like, a couple things that weren't as intense as that, but alcohol being the main one of them. But I mean, I just made people around me miserable, and my life was really sad. It was really small. I couldn't move. I had a teaching job somehow, and you know, I was just in so much pain emotionally and physically. And I, my family eventually sat me down and was like, you are fucking awful to be around. Like, we don't want to be around you. It's miserable. Like, and this is like my extended family that had been visiting for like 5 days. Like, they had had enough after 5 days, you know? And that was probably the first time I expressed that I, like, didn't have control over my drinking and using. And, like, I didn't have – I remember saying, like, I don't know what else to do. At this point, like, my mom and I were sharing drugs. She doesn't do a lot of drugs, but she sure has a lot. And so I was just taking whatever she gave me. I actually – I think I have enough time to tell the story. No, I don't. Ah, oh, fuck it, I'll do it. Like, my family, wow. My family, we took a family photo when they were in town that that time, like, my entire, like, extended family. And I was on so many muscle relaxers that, like, in the photo, my smile is like, it's like I couldn't lift up my face and, like, take a family photo. And, like, we don't put that photo out at our house. Like, that's, like, the photo before rehab. I think my mom calls it. You know, it's just like a really sad, like, I couldn't do shit without drinking and using. So finally, my family, one of my family members has experience with people with addiction, and she was like, there are other ways, like, you can live your life a different way. Because I was like, I'm gonna die now. I mean, I was suicidal, I didn't want to live anymore. Like, 30 was far for me. I was thinking, like, if I made it to 30, that was a good long life. And I was like, that's far enough. So they said, yeah, there's treatment. And I was like, okay, I'll go in for chronic pain. Like, if they have a chronic pain program, I'll go. And thankfully, they just kind of, like, shoved me in there. And it was, like, a 12-step focused recovery program. Like, it was no one was fucking around there. And somehow, I was just desperate enough to, I went in at 22 for people here and people listening. It was real weird. I mean, thankfully, I was in a program with women my age, which was really, really shitty at first, because I didn't, like, have a lot of relationships with women, and I was really uncomfortable. And thankfully, like, I got to see women taking initiative, getting into recovery, getting into AA, going to NA, like, all these different programs. And, like, I saw other people picking up the tools and the solution, and other people my age. And so I was like, oh, that is possible. And somehow I had I try and, like, pinpoint, like, at what point I became willing. And I don't really know. All I know is that I was desperate enough to start these steps, or really to just, like, focus on step one and make myself willing enough to start. And let's see. So, yeah, I mean, what it looks like today in this last 1 minute, because I talk too much. I do a lot of service. I got up at 6:15 the other day, to 6:15 a.m., to speak at a meeting. And it was actually a lot easier than this, because I hadn't, like, caffeinated and eaten a shit ton of sugar before it. But, you know, I say yes to service, and my sponsees keep me sober. And really what I'm doing right now is, like, getting so much from sharing what people have given me and, like, working these steps with other people. And, yeah, on a realistic note, like, I don't do my program, like, in a stellar way all the time. There's, like, a group of things I try to do every day, because I don't know which one will keep me sober today. And if I make a solid effort at doing all those for, let's say, five things, like, I've stayed sober so far, and I have no idea which one works. And that's what I tell my sponsees. Like, I try and do them every day. And a lot of the time when I'm telling my sponsees, like, I'm like, oh, yeah, I should do that shit too. So, yeah, thank you for letting me share. This speaker meeting has been a real help to me. Like, while I'm traveling, I listen to some of my friends when I miss them and I'm away. And I'm just really glad I can be of service. So, thanks.
I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
And I'm really glad to be here. It's nice to see everybody. I'm just going to say at the outset that I only speak for myself. I don't speak for AA. I can only relate to you what it was like for me and what happened to me and what it looks like to me now. But I can say that when I got here, it seems to me at this point that all I really needed was a willingness to keep an open mind and a willingness to keep coming back. And the willingness to keep coming back is actually kind of a spiritual principle for me today, so I'm going to come back around that. It's not a real sentence, but still. My sobriety date is February 20th, 1986. I started drinking when I was 13. I went on a mildly chaperoned school trip, and somebody handed me a beer, and I drank it. And I did not have an epiphany. I did not have this sense of, I found the elixir of life that I've been looking for all my life. But I guess most 13-year-olds are probably kind of fucked up because it's a hard age. But my sense was that I had been fucked up since I was tiny. I had never known a time when I was really particularly relaxed. I didn't know why other kids did the things they did or talked the way they did. I didn't know how to be a kid. I didn't know how to talk. I didn't know how to do life, insofar as kids know how to do life. But it seemed to me that some of those other kids were kind of carefree, and I didn't know what that was like. So having taken that drink and not had any huge effect, I will go on to say that within a few months I was routinely drinking into blackout. The other thing about that is I didn't look at it. I didn't think about it. I didn't consider what that meant, and that set a pattern for the entire rest of my drinking. You would have thought that I might have gone, you know, a little while ago I wasn't drinking, and now I drink and I can't remember what I did and I wake up sick. Maybe I should think about that. Not at all. I'm a drunk, and being drunk feels normal to me, and I just dived right in, and that's how I did it the rest of the time. I told myself that I was having fun. I used alcohol to get big and to get wild and to get crazy and to be the person I absolutely could not be without it, because I was actually scared and timid. But drunk, there wasn't much I wouldn't do. So in high school, a lot of kids do drugs and alcohol, and you can kind of hide amongst the dabblers. But after high school, it started to change. Bill in the Big Book talks about that certain kind of heavy drinker that, given sufficient motivation, can stop or moderate. And it turned out some of the people I drank with were like that. So what they did was start to change their drinking to fit what they were choosing for their lives. What I did was to change my life to fit my drinking. I was the guy that was always like, if I was out with a group of people, I was like, let's have another round. And I started to hear that thing that any alcoholic dreads to hear, which is, no thanks, I got to get up in the morning. And I'd be like, fuck you. What the fuck is that, Mr. Like, have a job? But I didn't have any life skills at all. I did not know how to live. I did not have any idea what to do. I was just kind of cast on. My parents apparently didn't have any idea either, so I was just kind of wandering around. I went to a college for a while and drunk my way out of that. I got a job with the only reason I got it is I knew the guy from high school, and his father had started the company, and it was kind of like a super early version of a startup. And everybody was really young, and we all used drugs and alcohol, so it was great. So we moved around a lot. We moved from city to city, and we lived in motels, and we did drugs and alcohol, and then we got up in the morning, and we went to work. And I was young and resilient, and I could pull that off, and I was kind of proud of myself. I thought it showed that I had strong character, that I could, you know, get wasted as fuck and then just roll out of bed and go grit it out, you know. And gritting it out was really kind of the theme of my drinking. It was just like... So I did that for a while, and that job took me out here, and I had a high school girlfriend that was going to art school out here, and I thought, maybe I'll try that. So didn't really have a plan. So I moved in with her in a little house in North Oakland, and I hunkered down, and that's when I really started kind of doing my real drinking. At first, it wasn't all that bad. I mean, when I drank, I got drunk, sure, but she kind of tolerated that, and I was fairly genial. And I would get kind of dumb, and then I would sort of fall asleep. And that wasn't so bad. And it was kind of sweet, I guess, if you didn't know what was to come. But we would go over to her friend's house, mostly, her friend's houses, and they had families, and they were like normal people. And I would get too drunk, and I would have, you know, I'd help myself to their beer and wine, and I might say a few inappropriate things, and then I might fall asleep on their couch, and that was all well and good, not so bad. And she would call them up after and apologize for me and say, you know, Chris is having a real hard time at work, and he's been under a lot of stress. And then she would put a glass of water on the night table with some aspirin, because she was a huge co. And I relied on her utterly. She took care of me. She really did. And I did that for a while, for some years. I just kind of, you know, got drunk as much as I could, and I didn't really get into a huge amount of trouble. I had some close things, but I don't guess it was so bad. And if it had stayed like that, I probably wouldn't be here, because I'm willing to tolerate a really fucking shitty little life as long as it's not on fire. But what happened is it got worse, and I drank more and more frequently with worse results. And also what happened is I started getting super resentful, and I started hating the world. Because, see, the gulf between what I imagined my life ought to be and what I was capable of doing kept getting bigger and bigger, and it made me furious. And it made me resent everybody that seemed like they were getting along so well. And I had this little thing in my head going, it's not fair, I can't catch a break, God damn it, why does everything always fuck up? Nothing ever works out. So I was becoming more and more full of self-pity, and anger and resentment was just piling up inside of me, and I drank it down, and I drank it down. And that just went on and on and on. At some point, I started to go insane. All of that shit that I was stuffing down with alcohol, the alcohol stopped being very effective in getting me away from it. In fact, it started amplifying it. At first, I just kind of got weird. So when we would go over to those people's houses and... where I used to get a little bit genial, I started getting a little rough, and I want to play like really enthusiastic Airplane with their kids. And when they would come over and snatch their child away from me because they didn't want me to hurdle him through a plate glass window, I would get super resentful at how uptight they were, and then I would pass out behind their couch. And that got a little harder to explain, and I stopped getting invited to some of those kind of things. And all the while, I was developing this sense of despair and this fury at what was going on, but I could not put it together with my drinking. I could not say, you know, every time I get in trouble and every shitty thing that happens, I'm drunk. I didn't have the capacity, I had that strange blank place in my mind to put those things together. So I thought life was happening to me. I thought it was something that was just raining down on my head, and I would wake up in the morning after some spree, vaguely remembering some humiliating thing, and I would be like, I hate it when that shit happens. God damn it. Like, you know, like somebody had bumped into me, or it had rained when I was out without an umbrella. Like it was, you know, just happenstance. And I did not have the capacity to say to myself or anyone else, my drinking is ruining my life. I didn't know it. I didn't have any information. I was doing the best I could with what I had on hand. I was alone with my drunk. I think of my alcoholism as my drunk. I don't know if that's medically or psychologically sound, but that's how I do it. This person that I carry with me that pretty much wants me dead. And I didn't have any of you, and I didn't have any principles, and I didn't have a higher power, and I didn't have any information. Just like all of us, when I was out there, I was alone with my drunk, and we were pissed. So what started to happen is when I drank, I got violent. I'd already been doing that shitty thing that people, drunks like me, do, where I had been cheating and lying and betraying my girlfriend. And when she called me on it, I explained it was because she was a crazy bitch. And I tried to gaslight her and make her think it was somehow her fault. And then when it got bad enough where it was going to break, I would have this tearful kind of, you know, swear my love for her forever and beg her forgiveness and promise to do better over and over and over again. So that was getting kind of grim. And then I started breaking shit. I started busting stuff up in the house. I started doing things like my girlfriend would say, last night you were speaking in tongues and you were trying to do some kind of extremely vigorous activity involving bug spray and bread, and I'm not sure. And I had to wrestle it out of your hands because I was afraid you were going to hurt yourself. And I was like... And I remember one night I was driving with some friends, and I said, pull over, pull over. And I kind of tumbled out of the car, and I crawled into a lawn and started eating the grass. I vaguely remember my motivation. It was because I felt like I was really sick, and I needed something wholesome in me. I wasn't wrong. I just didn't have a good way to go about it. But then I started doing things like, you know, I'd just fly into a rage and I would smash stuff up. And I would smash stuff that I knew my girlfriend loved to hurt her. And I would smash stuff at other people's houses. And when they called me on it, I would resent them for being too materialistic. Because I was still running on this idea that I was a free spirit, that I didn't stand on, you know, all this fucking, you know, timetables and jobs and, you know, acting normal and, you know, what's the big deal? I was mad at everybody. And I would destroy stuff on the street. I would abruptly fly into a rage for whatever reason, maybe because somebody glanced at me, and I took out a lot of newspaper stands and awnings and shit like that. But I still didn't put it together. I still didn't say, I think I need to do something about my drinking because I'm clearly going mad. I just thought, God damn it, life is hard. And it's getting harder. And it's really, really not fair. And I felt more sorry for myself, and I got more embittered. And that went on for a long time, except getting stranger and scarier and weirder, and I started doing more arrestable and scary things. I walked up a BART tunnel because I was curious what was up there. Can't really count for it. So anyway, what happened to me was I had a moment of clarity, and I don't know why I got to have that, because my brother died behind his disease and he never got that, and I've known people that have come in and they didn't ever really get it, and they left and they drank and they died. I'm not better or harder working than those people, so I can't account for this. All I can say is that I have a debt of gratitude that I can never fully repay, that I take very seriously. And I can tell you exactly what happened. I worked in the city in North Beach. It was going to be another long, hard night. I'd had a lot of long, hard nights with a lot of misadventures, and this was maybe somewhat more harrowing, but not really all that different. And after work, I would come down the hill, and there was a bus stop with where there was a bar, and what would happen is the bus wouldn't be there, so I'd go into the bar and get a drink, and then partway through my drink, the bus would come. Well, I couldn't very well leave my drink, so the bus would go, and then I'd finish my drink, but there was no bus, so I'd have to order another one. You kind of see where this is going. So I did this for a while, and I got pretty wasted, and then I wandered out of there, and I wandered into a club down the street, and I had more drinks, and I got really wasted, which is how I liked it. And by really wasted, I mean I can barely walk and I can barely talk. And so the bouncer found me, and he said, sir, you appear to be extremely intoxicated. I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And he wasn't really asking. He pretty muscled me out of there. And I immediately turned around and tried to force my way back in because that pissed me off. And I was really good at it. I was like, and I always remember the woman at the door gave me that look that I had come to know, which was pity because I was a pathetic drunk, and disgust because that's what I had earned. And I wasn't scary, and I wasn't going to hurt anybody, because if you'd put your finger on the middle of my chest and pushed, I would have fallen over. They just, it's like, get out of here. Christ. Waste of space. So the bouncer came and found me and twisted my arm behind the back to make sure that I understood he really didn't want me there, and kind of threw me onto the sidewalk. Okay, so now I'm pissed, because I have not been treated with the respect that I am entitled to. So I start wandering down the street of from North Beach to downtown to get on the BART train, and I'm at this point I'm just kind of yelling at everybody and nobody. I'm a street loon. This is where this is taking me. I'm one of those guys that people cross the street because I'm just hoarsely shouting out abuse. And I get downtown and I go down to the BART train, and there's a guy down there, and he looks at me. Maybe he just glanced at me, but in my mind he was, you know, like, loser. And I said, fly you, motherfucker. And I pulled a knife on him. I carried a Bowie knife because I did some work that involved that. Now, maybe looking at me, you can kind of tell I'm not really a knife fighter. It's not my trade. I don't come from a line of knife fighters. But I'm an alcoholic, and when an alcoholic is drinking, alcohol calls the shots, and it takes you where it will, and that's where it took me, standing in a BART station with a knife in my hand. Surprisingly, the guy didn't go, "Oh, excuse me, sir, I didn't realize you were a badass. Please be on your way. I apologize." He whipped his coat off and started whipping it at the knife and shouted, "This guy's showing a blade, call the cops." In retrospect, I'm a little weirded out that he was that prepared for a knife. I mean, that was awfully specific. It seemed like he was like, "You trained in this?" So I summoned up all of my alcoholic courage and I ran away as fast as I could, and I was freaked out. I was like, "What the fuck? What did I?" Blah. And I ran back up to street level, and I thought, "I know what I'll do. I'll turn my coat inside out, and that way they won't recognize me. And then I'll go to a BART station way up the line where they haven't heard tell." So there I was in downtown San Francisco with an inside-out coat, all disheveled, shrieking abuse. That's where my disease took me, ultimately. And I did find a BART train up the ways, and I got on the train, and I passed out, and I woke up at the end of the line. I had a lot of trouble with BART. I used to drink on BART routinely. I'd bring beers with me, and I'd sit there drinking, and when people would be kind of like, "Dude," I'd be like, "Fuck you, sheep. I'm my own man." I woke up at the end of the line. There's no way to get back. I had to call my girlfriend. She came out more in, you know, sorrow than anger, because this was kind of not that unusual. And I got in the car, and something in me broke for whatever reasons. And I think at that moment I was done. I didn't know it yet. But I had a thought that I had never had before, which was, I need help. There were a couple of reasons I'd never had that thought. One of them was I didn't think there was help for what ailed me, which after all was, everything sucks, the world's horrible, I'm horrible, nothing works, you can't catch a break, and I just have to drink to get through it and manage as best I can. What's the help for that? The other one was, even if there was help, I didn't think there would be help for someone like me, because help is for good people down on their luck, and I was a shitty person fucking up. So I deserve punishment. It had never occurred to me that there might be anything like this, but something up inside me rose up and said that, and I don't think it was me. Having had that moment, shit started to happen, and I did different things. I don't remember exactly in what order, because it's all kind of confused, but some stuff happened, and for one thing, I called AA. I had no idea what AA was, literally no idea. But apparently our outreach works like fog and it gets out into the world, because I had some vague idea that if you had a problem with drinking, you were supposed to call AA. I remember worrying a bit that it was a drinking moderation program, and I knew that that was going to be horrible and I couldn't do it, but I figured I'd check it out.
Yeah.
So I called the hotline, and a nice lady read me some questions, and I answered yes to most of them. And she said, "Sounds like you're one of us, honey." And I said, "Huh," and I hung up and I kept drinking. And I went and saw a shrink because I figured I'm probably crazy, right? And for some reason, I gave him a kind of accurate drunkalog, which I had never done. I mean, my stock answer for doctor question of how much you drink was, "I have a few beers now and then," which is true as far as it goes, in the sense, you know, that there are some drops of water in the ocean. But I actually told him some truth, and he said this. He said, "You were doing arrestable and institutionalizable things now, and it's just blind luck that that hasn't happened. If you want to go and drink like you're drinking and come back in 6 months, assuming you're free to do so, it's going to be much worse, because in my professional opinion, you are now going over the waterfall into the next stage of alcoholism. You've already started to feel some of it. It's going to go fast now." And I said, and kept drinking. But then I was at my job in North Beach, and I was sitting on some stairs one day, and a woman that I kind of knew from work sat down next to me and said, "How you doing?" And I said, "I'm really tired." And she said, "Like hungover?" Now, as far as I knew, she had never seen me drink, but it turns out that I didn't know very far when it came to my drinking, and no doubt at some event or another, I had gotten insanely drunk. Bill Wilson talks, at some point he says something like, "This is the guy we've been talking about, when he's drinking, he's more or less insanely drunk." That was me. If I had a drink, I was pretty sure to be nuts. So she said, "Like hungover," and that was a conversation that I'd never wanted to have. If my girlfriend wanted to talk about my drinking, and I'd say, not now, not in the morning, I'm hungover. Or I'd say, not now, midday, I'm busy. Or I'd say, not now, not at night, I'm tired. Or, not now, I'm actually drunk at the moment. And if any of my friends wanted to talk about it, I was basically like, na-na-na-na, can't hear you. Because I could not have that conversation because I had to drink. And what's to discuss? I mean, I can't explain it. It's just what I need to do, and I wish I could avoid the consequences for sure. I never wanted to drink like a normal person, but I sure did want to drink without having people be mad at me and without getting sick and without doing insane things. But that just wasn't in the cards. So by some strange miracle, when she said, like hungover, I said yes. Her name was Phoebe, and I don't know where she is anymore, but she saved my life. I didn't even know I was reaching out, but the hand of AA was there, and that's why I owe that debt of gratitude. And I always want to be there when somebody reaches out, because she did that for me. And she said, I know something about that. Do you want to go to a meeting? And I said, yeah. And in my memory, that meeting was in a room the size of a gymnasium with about 300 people receding into darkness. It was at Alta Bates. It was a normal-sized room. There were about 30 people there. But that's how it struck me. And so I started going to meetings. And the first thing I noticed is that some of the people there had drunk more than me. And I thought, oh, my God, did I fuck this up too? Am I not really an alcoholic? I mean, maybe the whole street loon thing was just a phase because I was having trouble with my girlfriend. I don't know. But then what I realized was if I listened to their stories, there were people who drank like me up to the point that I came in, and then they kept drinking, and I got to see what the next 10 to 20 or 30 years looked like. Spoiler alert, not good. So I kind of made my peace with that, but then I noticed it's like, it appears there's some work involved. And I'm like, I don't know, because, you know, I had never had much success at going at stuff. The only two things I've ever done consistently in my entire life was drink and, it turns out, recover from drinking. But at the time, I had a very bad track record with taking things on. And I'm like, if this requires some kind of self-discipline and work ethic, we may have a problem. It turned out it didn't. But I'll get back to that. I did that for about 6 months, and then my girlfriend and I had a huge knockdown, drag-out fight. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get drunk at her, and then she'll feel bad for making me hurt myself. Because I'm a genius. And I did that, and she said, fuck this noise. I'm getting in the car and driving to the airport, and I'm going to fly away forever. I always think about this as kind of emblematic of the waste and loss and terribleness of alcoholism, because this was a pivotal moment in my life, and this woman I'd had a relationship with for over 15 years, and she cared for me, and she was saying she was going to leave forever, and my one and only thought was, good, I can drink easier. And I did. She left. She came back about an hour later. I'm like, what the fuck? I thought you were gone forever. I'm drinking here. Anyway, I woke up the next morning and hungover. And it was an interesting thing, because if you had asked me what I got out of that 6 months of going to meetings, you know, I showed up, guys would want to talk to me after the meeting, and I would put on this extremely neutral, pleasant face and go, and then I would get the fuck out of there, because it was weird, and they seemed to think that they had something they needed to impart to me, and they seemed to imply that they knew me, which obviously they didn't. I was way different from these guys, and it was super presumptuous, and I kind of hated it. But when I woke up that morning, apparently some kind of little bit of connectedness from these rooms had gotten into me, because it was gone and I felt it. And I'd never felt colder and more alone in my life, even after all the hangovers. But I had touched something different that I'd never touched before, and then dropped it when I drank. So I came back. She left. Sobriety was the straw that broke that camel's back. And I had a tiny little studio and a $300 car, and that was perfect because I really didn't have anything else going on, and I just started doing this. And I got a sponsor, and he moved away, and I got another sponsor. I didn't really like him, and I got another sponsor, and he was the sweetest, most gentle man I've ever known in my life. I love him dearly. He passed away. His name was Trevor, and he took me through the steps. And I've modeled my sobriety on his. That's how I work with sponsees, gently. I know some people need maybe a drill sergeant, or they need tough love, and that's fine, because there's plenty of people that will do that. You can find them. I don't do that, and I'll tell you why. I have spent a big chunk of my life inflicting the most savage, brutal, bloodthirsty hatred against myself for all the things I haven't been able to do and all the ways I've fucked up and all the stuff that I can't figure out. And I'll be fucked if I'm going to bring any of that energy into my sobriety, because it's not like that, I don't think. I don't think that this is what this is about. It's a practice. It's an open door. It's an invitation. So, you know, we did them. I did a first step, and my sponsor had me, I kind of felt like I'd worked the first step just by being out there and doing this, but he had me write stuff down, and that was my first exposure to this principle that I had the opportunity to take the stuff out of my foggy head where anything can be rationalized and anything can turn into anything else and there's no truth or it's just all haze, and write it down, and then it becomes real and it becomes stable. And doing that, I got to have a good look at how alcohol actually had worked in my life and what I really used it for, and that was very helpful. The second and third steps for me were just kind of a willingness to commit to this thing, that say, yeah, I am here, I am going to do this. I will say this, and I've said this before, some of you may have heard it, that I came in here carrying my life like a waterlogged, rolled up carpet that smelled of piss and smoke. It was heavy. And you guys said, you know, you can put that down. And I did, and it was a fantastic relief, because I had been carrying this terrible feeling of like, I'm so stupid and wrong and bad, and I fucked up so much and nothing works, and why am I such an idiot and why is everything so fucked up? And my sponsor said, you don't have to fix yourself, you don't have to figure anything out, you just have to surrender and let go. And I said, yes, okay, thank you. And I got a God box, and I filled it up with stuff that said, I'm a stupid fucking idiot alcoholic, and I have no idea what's going on, and I don't know how to do this, and I am completely at my wit's end. Here, have it. And I did a lot of that, and it felt great. It felt great for the first time in my life to just stop and go, I don't know, I give up, I guess I actually don't know how to do life, and just focus on the next right thing with you guys. My fourth and fifth step was another step down that road of getting stuff out of my head. I had a chance to learn how I operated. I found out that I was fairly petty. I kind of thought maybe I was a Bond villain or something along those lines, but it turns out I was just a regular garden variety, resentful, fearful alcoholic that had a lot of opinions about things. I also found out that I'm incredibly reactive. I could just give you like a list of remarks and you could read them to me and watch me respond like a vending machine, just like bung, 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 bung. Didn't know it. The sixth and seventh steps were a chance for me to, I had a friend that used to call it living in light of the facts. I'm not going to become willing to let go of this shit until I can see it not working in my life, basically. But once I have identified it and looked at it, I can't not notice. Sometimes we talk about how drinking, I mean, AA ruins your drinking. And by which we mean if you come in here, even if you go back out and drink, you can never again drink with quite that sense of oblivion and not knowing. You will always kind of know that there's another way, and you can't unlearn that. My six and seven steps were like that. They, you know, it kind of ruined my character defects because I could no longer pretend like it was you. I couldn't pretend like it was the universe. I kind of knew it was me. And in some ways, that was a little bit like, but in some ways, it was hugely liberating because I had spent my whole life just enraged and trying to make the world change by being mad at it, you know? And nothing changed, and nobody did what I want, and the world never did what I want, and I was just like grinding on that so hard, and it was exhausting. And so to be able to let go of that and go, that's not what it's about. Here's something you actually have some control over. You know, you can look at your own response system. You can make that choice to let stuff go. That was amazing. Eighth and ninth step, I got to let go of some of the guilt and shame that I felt around how I behaved. Most of my amends were to the people I had emotionally abused, and they've taken on the form of kind of a living amends where I remain in those people's lives, and I'm available to them, and I have won their trust. I've done that with my parents and my ex-girlfriend and friends that I had betrayed. There was no reason for them to believe me if I just came and showed up and said, hey, I'm real sorry about all that. So I have continued to be in their lives and tried to be of service any way I could. And then 10, 11, and 12 is ongoing. I want to speak, though, for a second about 11, because you may have noticed I haven't really talked very specifically about a power greater than myself and how it works in my life. And that's kind of deliberate because it doesn't really matter. For me, I needed, lack of power was my dilemma. I needed a power that was greater than me. It was kind of like the grass thing, you know. I needed something wholesome that I could get at. And my conception of that, even if I tried to explain it, wouldn't make any sense because it's changed. It keeps changing. But the important thing is, it's something I can draw on. There are things that I can do to make me more open to that power, and there are things I can do to make me less open, so I like to choose the things that make me more open. And I want to develop that relationship. But I know people who are agnostics and atheists who have long-term happy sobriety. I know people who use nature. I know people who use the sense of the group. I know people who have a sense of connectedness or just a higher self. So it's all good, and I think anything anybody does, like I said, all I really needed was to keep an open mind and be willing to come back. And on that matter of coming back, I wanted to touch briefly. When I was about 17, I think, years sober, I apparently decided I had learned enough and I kind of wandered off. I didn't consciously choose that, but I did. So it turns out my alcoholic had been sitting on a back bench very patiently, and when I started to move away from AA, he leapt to his feet and he said, "Hey, you know what? Those guys are assholes. They're full of shit. They don't know you. They just spout a lot of slogans and cliches, and they all say the same thing over and over again." And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why don't we stop going to meetings and do this on ourselves?" And I said, "Yeah." It's a funny thing because you hear it over and over again, and I listen for it. When people move away from their program, they say, "My life got smaller." You hear it over and over again. "My life got smaller," which means, whether I knew it or not, my life had been getting bigger. And by bigger, I don't mean like I got the plum job or the plum relationship or the big house. I mean I had more and better relationships. That's actually the life beyond my wildest dreams that I have today, is that I have a network of people that I love, and they love me, and I have a relationship with a power greater than myself, and I have a relationship with myself. And that makes my world feel huge. But I dropped all that, and my world shrank back down to the size of my poor little alcoholic, bewildered head, and it was hell. And I didn't drink because I think my first step really did take that I really truly know that there's nothing that a drink won't make worse, and that just sounds miserable. But I was actively researching techniques for suicide because and somehow I wasn't quite figuring out that I could just go back. Anyway, I was binge watching Celebrity Rehab. And if you've never seen that, it's this crazy funhouse mirror inverted recovery thing where narcissistic celebrities act out on camera and a kind of fucked up fake celebrity therapist doctor guy rides herd on them all. And I think actually a bunch of them died, so they had to take it off the air. But I watched it all, and I finished the last show of the last season, and I closed my laptop, and I went, "Oh, Jesus Christ, I need a real meeting." So thank you, Celebrity Rehab, for being instrumental in my recovery. The next day, I went to a meeting, and it had been a while, and things had changed a bit. It seemed like people were a lot younger, there were a lot more tattoos, and there was a lot more chanting things in unison, which kind of weirded me out. It still does a little. I don't know when we started that. But that didn't matter. It didn't matter because I had bottomed out around the idea that I can do this by myself, so I kept coming back. And the last 12, 13 years of my sobriety have been the best years of my life and the best years of my sobriety only because I came back and I became willing to keep an open mind and I did some simple things. It's really not that hard. It's not a lot that's being asked of us, and it didn't require a bunch of self-discipline and, you know, going at it like a maniac. I just needed to be willing to do the next thing. I subscribed to the One Fork at a Time school of sobriety from the probably apocryphal story of the guy that calls the sponsor, and he goes, "I got a sink full of dishes, and I'm frozen up, I'm overwhelmed," and his sponsor goes, "Can you wash one fork?" And he's like, "Stay on the phone." It's like, "Okay, I can do that." And it's like, "Well, can you wash a spoon?" You know, and so in effect, fork at a time, the dishes get done. So fork at a time, my life has been changed. And at no point was it like, I got to really buckle down and grit this out, because I'm no good at that. But I can break it up into doable bits. I can take it day at a time. I can keep coming back, and I can keep an open mind. Now, this keep coming back thing, it's true of everything. It's not just meetings. I can keep coming back to relationships, the relationships that at one time I would have walked away from the second that it got hard. I can keep coming back to prayer and meditation, no matter how far off the beam I've gotten, no matter how crazy I've made myself, and whatever I've chosen not to do, at any moment in the day, I can keep coming back, because this is not a job, this is not school, this is not something that I'm going to break. All my drinking life, I would make these little runs at self-improvement, and I would fuck them up. And as soon as it went wrong, I would say, what's the fucking use anyway, and I'd walk away. AA is not that. AA is not a project that I can break. AA is something that I can return to at any moment, any time in the day, any time I feel like it. And that's super important for me because I, like I say, I have a pretty grim track record. I don't know what happens after 5 minutes. I don't know where we're in there now.
Yeah, four.
Four, okay. Okay, so I'll close with just a really brief anecdote that kind of maybe speaks to where I'm at today. I was going over to a friend's house. I work at a school now, and this is a former student. So I get to be friends with former students that I taught at a school. There is no reason for that to be happening. That makes no sense to me because, you know, that they even let me in the school in the first place, for one thing. And I was going to meet her for dinner, and I was running late, and I was on Masonic near Gary in the city, and there's a Trader Joe's there, and the dude who was controlling the parking lot was keeping people from entering the parking lot from Masonic so that people could leave. Except he did it for a while, and Masonic was backing up. So, good sober person that I am, I rolled down my window and I said, what the fuck are you doing? Jesus Christ, can you not see that the fucking road is backing up here? And then I rolled my window up and I'm just like, Jesus damn. And then I glance over and the guy's approaching my car and I'm like, okay, here we go. DEFCON 4. And I rolled down my window and the guy gives me the sunniest, most beautiful smile, and he goes, I'm sorry. So I said, you know what? Nope, I'm sorry. I was being an impatient asshole, and I apologize to you, sir. Thank you. And I meant that with all sincerity, and there was no kind of sense like, you know, he tricked me into it or anything like that. It was like instantaneous. So I had the bullshit, you know, I had the impatient gnarliness, but I also had the other stuff that I carry with me now because I've been doing this and you're with me. I don't have to do it alone ever again, and I'm never alone. People in the rooms are with me, the principals are with me, a power greater than myself is with me, and that's what I never had. I was alone with my alcoholic in hell for so many years, and I never have to do that again as long as I'm willing to keep coming back. Is that about it?
You had two.
Oh, wonderful. But that was like a good wrap-up, right?
That's probably fine.
Huh?
That's probably fine.
Okay, good.